Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. We're here at Berlin still, and there's actually quite a few movies left to talk about. And I'm very happy to have joined me for the first time, I guess, since, I want to say Venice?
Since Venice, yeah.
Since Venice, Jonathan Romney.
Hello.
You're filing, as usual, with Screen.
Screen and The Observer, doing a roundup.
Yeah. All right. And how has the festival been generally for you by this point?
It's been very good. It's strange. I mean, it feels strange being here because I remember in 2020, it had suddenly, the place, the area around Potsdamer Platz had gone very dead immediately before lockdown. I remember this is the first place I was where people were talking about COVID, and then very shortly after, the world shut down. And this was presaged by the Arkaden Mall shutting down just before the festival. And then this year, the mall has reopened and is somehow bleaker than it was before. I mean, it feels like a kind of huge airport lounge, but it's a strange place to be because yeah. Potsdamer Platz has always had this problem of being kind of a non-place. You know, it was no man's land, and now it's continues to be, except with, you know, the odd cafe where, you know, you have to wait a long time to get served because it's there are two cafes in that street, and, you know, it's not a party place, you know. Unlike certain other A-list festivals, there are not people sort of strolling around with, you know, in fedoras catching the sun.
No, it is a strange experience as a festival-like locus. Do you feel this is like a strong addition particularly, or?
I was worried about it at the start. And, I feel one of the problems with Berlin, it's often been one of those festivals where even, and this goes back quite a long way, even the films that did really well in competition and that were noticed here would not necessarily register in any real way in the outside world. Right. And it often felt as if the market here was all about getting deals for films that actually wouldn't really be seen except at other festivals. I think platforms have probably changed that, but there are still a lot of films which will not necessarily be, you know, they may play on platforms, they may not be noticed. However, having said that, I think it's turned out to be a really strong year. I haven't been around the other sections that much, but the competition has actually been very strong, very varied, very interesting. You know, it hasn't sort of delivered on star names, if that's the kind of thing that you want. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Berlinale goers don't necessarily want that, you know. This festival has not kind of been beholden to stardom in the same way that Cannes or Venice are. Obviously, they thrived on that, particularly in the last... Venice has had a huge sort of resurgence of star power in the last few years. But it may be that a festival like this year proves that Berlin doesn't actually need that. If it can really deliver a strong and varied selection, then that's probably a very healthy thing for its survival.
I think I agree with that. And I mean, almost like the exemplary case could be the first movie that we'll talk about. I mean, it's a, you know, very well established and distinctive filmmaker, but, you know, definitely a film that benefits from the festival atmosphere for thriving. And that is Music from Angela Schanelek, probably the film of the festival to a certain extent.
I would say it's certainly the most, you know, hardcore selection for cinephiles. It's really daring. It's very strange. I mean, Angela Schanelek is a really mysterious director, and I don't really understand what she does or how she's doing it or why, but I'm entranced by her work. And the last film she had here called I Was at Home, But... I found completely mystifying when I saw it here. I had no idea what she was doing. I then saw it again because I wrote a piece about her and went back and watched her other work. And it was really, I don't know, I had this kind of glimmer of insight, not necessarily of understanding, but I think the word Music, which is the title of a new film, is very revealing because she approaches narrative as music in a way. She's absolutely a minimalist. She's absolutely into narrative deconstruction. She rejects any traditional notion of character, but not traditional notions of plot, because what she's done in this film is it's her version of the Oedipus myth, but it's not obviously flagged up. So you could very easily watch the film having no idea that this was the Oedipus story.
Yeah.
And you could be completely mystified. Even knowing that it is, you may still be mystified. And it's set partly in Greece, and then suddenly it jumps to Berlin, just round the corner, in fact, on the corner of Potsdamer Platz.
Oh, right, yeah.
One of the odd things about it is I wasn't entirely sure whether, at any given point, character X is necessarily character X, or the same actor playing different clothes, playing the double of that character. It's very elusive, but basically the best known person in it, Agat Bonitzer, plays a prison guard who is stationed at the prison where the Oedipus character has been sentenced for manslaughter, I guess. And later she becomes his partner. You don't quite find out how or why. There's almost no dialogue in it. Music doesn't come into it for almost an hour, but when it does, it plays a very distinctive part. It's almost like a kind of, it's very hard to know quite what's going on or how to describe it, but it's almost like the narrative has been boiled down to a set of symbols. I'd almost say mathematical symbols. It's like, you know, Oedipus plus Jocasta divided by, you know, that kind of thing. It's very diagrammatic in a way.
Yeah,
I don't really know the aspect how music plays a part, but there's a moment in it where there's a sheet on the wall with various names of composers, and it's almost like a playlist for the film you're about to see.
Yeah, it's true. I really agree that it is a kind of more musical in structure than cinematic, and it's a way, it's a kind of methodology that I appreciated more than I could always engage with. It just came to feel more withholding than not, which unfortunately makes one begin to feel that it's sort of coy, which seems like absolutely the strangest word to use for a movie that's this like astringent in a way. So that got a little frustrating, but I found when I had some distance from the movie, then I could like it more. But the actual experience of watching this movie was not pleasant because I felt like it was constantly, I wouldn't even say circling, it's like doing whatever the night move is in chess, you know, that's the kind of unpredictable movement it does.
But it's very strange and it's very seductive, and it's actually pared down and detached in the way that Straub-Huillet films are, except there is this really strong element of visual pleasure. Like every shot is incredibly crafted. There's a choreography to the way people move.
Yeah,
people look as though they've been painted. There are these elements that work their way throughout the film. Like at the beginning, there's a character wearing a red jacket, and later on, there's someone else wearing a similar shade, but on a different garment.
Yeah.
One person is wearing glasses, then those same glasses seem to be worn by someone else.
Yeah.
There are all these sort of mysterious touches, like the prisoners in this jail. The men are all wearing these kind of rather beautiful sort of knitted vests, white lamb's wool knitted vests, and wearing these strange clogs, which are like, you know, the famous shoes that were worn in Greek tragedy.
Yeah.
And you're not quite sure how it adds up, but you have to sort of, it's almost as if she's left you with this machine that it's like she set up this film, and as a filmmaker departed.
Yeah.
It's like she's walked away from it and let you deal with all these elements that have to fit together somehow, and you have to make them resonate. You know, the way that you feel sometimes like a director's presence, even if there's not a lot of rhetoric going on, a director's presence may be really always present throughout the film, pushing you in a certain direction. It's as if she set this thing up and simply, you know, discreetly withdrawn and let the machinery of the film play itself out.
It's funny, I interviewed Albert Serra about Pacifiction, and I guess he has something that he says in a lot of interviews where he's like, yeah, well, I cut off the beginning and the ending of scenes. That's what I always do. And I'm like, buddy, you got nothing on what Shyamalan is doing. with this. So it's a movie that I will want to see again. And I have to say, I am one of those people who went in not reading anything about it. So consequently, although I began to suspect that there was a Greek tragedy element in it, I did not go in with that as a frame. I really was heading right into the maelstrom on this one.
But there are amazing things happening. There's some strange, just these kind of little miracles of timing. There's a moment when a character cycles through the prison gate just as it's about to close, and suddenly he's... And then there's another scene where someone jumps off a cliff, and at that very moment, just before she does that, a lizard just kind of appears out of nowhere and crawls onto her ankle. It's like, wow, how do you set that up? It's
And
it's clearly not a CGI lizard. You know, don't think Angela Shanlek would run to a CGI lizard, or even, you know, ethically, she wouldn't go for that. Yeah. I suspect
that lizard is a pretty miraculous moment, and that makes you feel that, oh, there is something especially mysterious going on here, beyond any of our ken. It's a movie that I'm definitely going to watch again, and I think almost invites you to watch it again. But maybe we can talk about another movie that, actually, this one you've seen and I haven't yet, maybe has more traditional narrative pleasures to it, and that's called Limbo.
Yeah, Limbo is a film by an Australian director, Ivan Sen, and I haven't seen his previous work. And I know that two of them, Mystery Road and Goldstone, I think it is a very highly rated, I believe, involve the same character. And his films have Aboriginal themes, Aboriginal characters. This is called Limbo, and it's set in a place, a town called Limbo, which is in the opal mining area, Coober Pedy of Queensland, which is a strange, desolate sort of lunar landscape of a place. It doesn't really resemble anything else I've seen in a film, but it's this kind of desert of, you know, ash-like stone that seems to go on forever. And it's about a detective played by Simon Baker, who is a heroin-addicted cop with a kind of religious fixation. He's listening to kind of evangelists in his car. So, you know, from the beginning, it's going to be a kind of redemption narrative. And basically, he's turned up in a small town to investigate, to possibly reopen a closed case about a young Aboriginal woman who disappeared 20 years earlier. And it's sort of quite clear in what goes on that, you know, the whole of this small community, this Aboriginal community, has been leaned on brutally by the white authorities. And he basically drives around investigating the loose threads of this story. So it's what you would call, you know, it's an existential mystery story. It's one of those thrillers that's all about, you know, why are these people in this place, and why do they not leave this place, and will he ever leave this place, and what's the place going to bring to him, and what's he going to bring to it? It has this wonderful, really kind of strange black and white parched imagery. People living near, or indeed even in, these opal mines, and kind of sifting through these stones to find opals that might be valuable. There's a very good turn by an actor called Nicholas Hope, who you may remember from Rolf De Heer's Bad Boy Bubby, who is playing, like, you know, the Australian equivalent of one of the Western school of crazed old coots. There's a very strong performance by an actor called Rob Collins, who is the guy whose sister disappeared years ago. And it's about families and fragmentation, and, you know, whether people whose lives have been destroyed, whether their lives can be somehow sewn back into shape again. But it's got an extraordinary atmosphere, dazzling photography, and I mean, it's one of the most, you know, it's a real, very, very much a slow burner, but it's definitely one of the most interesting things I've seen here, and, you know, with just an extraordinary visual style.
Yeah, that's something I'm going to have to catch up to at some point. I thought the third film we could talk about is a documentary from Nicolas Philibert, who people know from, I guess, you know, To Be and to Have is the kind of classic He did one about French radio.
The House of Radio. And he did one, his last film was about, if I remember right, it was about sort of nursing, a nursing college.
Oh, yeah, I missed that
and
one.
And he also made a couple of films. Well, he made a film called In the Land of the Deaf. He made a film called Every Little Thing that was set in a psychiatric center. And this film is a return to that territory because it's set in a psychiatric daycare center or a drop-in center.
Yeah.
In Paris, which is basically half building, half boat, specially designed building, moored on the banks of a Seine, created with consultation from psychiatric patients who would use it.
Yeah.
And it's a portrait of this place and the people who go there.
Yeah. It's called On the Adamant, or Adamant, I guess.
The Adamant, yeah.
And it's not a movie where they're trying to show people like at the end of their rope necessarily. I guess they're all there because they're basically, they can function in like this kind of art-friendly environment where they're each doing art therapy in different ways. But the any given time where you sit down and actually talk with one for a while, you know, half a minute in, you see the kind of patterns that they're in. There's one younger man that you talk to, and at first it seems like this kind of charming, he's making these charming observations about like, oh, this thing reminds me of that, you know, with the face, you know, the expression of the face. And then you're like, oh, that's kind of interesting. I wouldn't have thought of it that way. But then as he tries to explain why he thinks that, what he thinks, it immediately gets all kind of kinked and gnarled up in his thinking until he kind of hits a certain wall. And I found those moments pretty intense, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because I think what Philibert is out to do is present almost a kind of utopian vision of this place as a system he really believes in that shows the possibilities. And at the end of the film, there's even the captions saying, you know, this is a center which is operating, you know, in such and such a way. And then he goes, but for how long? Mm-hmm. So clearly this whole system of enlightened psychiatric care is endangered. But he's presenting it as, I think, you know, a near utopian picture of what the possibilities are. And I think for that reason, he's not showing us any of the problems. Mm-hmm. He's not showing anyone who is really very disturbed or very unhappy. He's showing people who are turning up and saying, look, this place is really good for me. This is a haven. I think that's what he wants to show you. I don't think it makes the film any weaker because it's not meant to be, it doesn't purport to be, an objective observation of a system. It's not a Frederick Wiseman film, but, you know, people always say of Philibert, well, he's a great humanist, and this is what he is. You know, he is interested in people, and he's interested in the way that people talk and the way they present themselves. And in a way, everyone in this film has their own language. So the young man you're talking about is acutely self-aware of, you know, what his own mental patterns are. So he's talking about how, you know, if he sees someone wearing a blue woolly cap, that will make him think of the word puree.
Right.
And that in turn will terrify him because it makes him think of death. And it's completely hermetic and mysterious, but he's really aware of how his own mental patterns work. There's another man who talks about his experience of psychiatry and how psychiatry works. Mm-hmm. And he actually says, you know, you've got to have the medicine first before you start talking, which is not the way we usually hear it. And there's an extraordinary character in there who I think almost merits a film in himself. Mm-hmm. He's this guy called Frédéric, who looks as if he's walked out of a Philippe Garrel film. He's got this sort of floppy fringe and he wears like velvet jackets, you know, and he's kind of late middle age. And he's like a sort of poet maudit type.
Yeah.
And he sits down at the organ and plays this extraordinary, sings this extraordinary song he's written about someone who's a researcher at UCLA who wants to make films like Agnès Varda, and he goes, you know, dreamer, rêveur, oh rêveur, never say never. And he's playing this song like, it's almost like kind of Terry Riley style organ. And it's beautiful and it's witty and the rhymes are incredibly ingenious. And he's got this beautiful kind of mellifluous sort of honeyed voice and this wonderful singing voice and wonderful speaking voice.
Yeah.
And he explains that these things come to him in his sleep, that mm-hmm. these songs are not written by him, they're written by, he says, his subconscious.
Yeah.
And
he transcribes them, I think he says, or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's wonderful. And they have, you know, there's like a sort of painting show and tell moment, which where the colors that people are achieving with their paints and watercolors are just extraordinary. And, you know, one of the paintings has the same kind of, you know, frisson of like a Van Gogh painting. It's, you know, it's kind of remarkable.
But also the building itself is wonderful because it's specially designed and it's like a houseboat.
Yeah.
And it has these shutters that open at the beginning of the film. And you really become aware of this very special space where clearly people can thrive. It doesn't feel like a sort of psychiatric day center. It feels like a sort of, you know, a sort of art center. And it has this wonderful, strange atmosphere. And everyone seems very... It's a safe haven. Literally, it's a haven.
Yeah.
You know, it's moored.
Yeah, and there's just an openness to it. And the center is not some antiseptic conference room or something. It's a coffee house, which is also kind of funny, where they, you know, a lot of the people participate, you know, and they'll learn how to sell. They'll learn how to run the counter. And I also love that the center of it is this kind of bohemian rather than something clinical.
Yeah. And there's this incredible woman who comes in who's like, you know, sort of quite elderly woman with a sort of, you know, leather jacket and a kind of punk fringe who was clearly, you know, at the forefront of the Parisian punk scene in the 70s. And she says, well, you know, I want to offer Tai Chi classes. And then she goes into this kind of wild sort of rant about, you know, the system. And it's brilliant. It's absolutely magnetic because she's so angry and yet she's got this environment in which she is allowed to kind of vent her spleen as long as she likes. And it's like, you know, in a kind of French hippie way, c'est cool.
Yeah,
you know?
I love. And the last thing I want to mention is that there's an older woman, I guess middle-aged, who like, they when they interview her, she immediately like throws it back to them.
Yeah.
And that ends up becoming this great little reflexive moment.
Yeah, Muriel, you know, she goes, so where do you live?
Yeah.
Where do you live, Nicolas?
Yeah, which just turns the tables in this wonderful way because she's completely unselfconscious about doing it. When I talk about it as intense, it's not like a euphemism that I think there's anything wrong with it, but they don't withhold anything about their personality and who the people are. And I ultimately very much appreciate that. And also that they don't try to cutesify them in any way as well. So, yeah, you get the full force at the end. Well, I think that's probably like the last film we'll talk about at length. But the end I did as a kind of bizarre dessert, just so people know about the film, Superpower.
Oh, God.
Just for a minute, because it's such like, I mean, it's okay.
Go ahead. All right. So this is Sean Penn's documentary about Ukraine, which could have been called How I Saved Ukraine by Sean Penn, featuring Volodymyr Zelensky. I mean, there's a bit of Zelensky in there, but there's a lot of Sean Penn with ridiculous hair, you know, kind of entertaining a kind of, you know, sort of Hemingway war reporter fantasy. He happened to be there making a documentary in Ukraine about Ukraine when the war broke out. So he was there. And he interviews Zelensky on the first day of the conflict, which is, you know, quite a remarkable thing.
Yeah.
He may actually have the first ever footage of Zelensky in the famous khaki t-shirt.
Yeah.
But then he gets out of the country. Then he comes back. It's like he's plaguing Zelensky. He's obviously thinking, oh, my God, you know, do I have to talk to Sean Penn again? And his advisors are probably going, well, look, it's either him or Boris Johnson. Okay, I'll take Sean Penn. But it's remarkably narcissistic and pompous. He talks to some very, very interesting people.
Yeah.
He doesn't give them time. He doesn't give them space. He cannot keep himself off camera. He doesn't realize that it's fundamentally indecent of him in this situation to plaster himself all over the film. And it's a monstrosity. And he's really, I think, made himself look quite a fool, but, you know, go tell him that. I don't think he would. He's obviously something. He's just not seeing this.
No, it's. I mean, it's an incredible demonstration of like the lack of self-consciousness that can make like a very powerful performance, you know. But in this case, it's real life. You know, he cannot and should not be front and center. Cannot and should not be telling Zelensky at one point as he does, you know, we're living through this really extreme moment in history.
But, you know, actually, he is only slightly less bad as a political interviewer than Werner Herzog. I don't know if you ever saw the film Herzog interviewing Gorbachev, where he comes to Gorbachev and say, "You know, Mr. Gorbachev, for my generation, you are the greatest politician that has ever been. And by the way, I have brought you a cake." At least Sean Penn does not bring Zelensky a cake.
That's true. Well, who knows? Maybe we'll have a whole series of Sean Penn documentaries now in the model for Herzog.
Yeah. I mean, you could do a great season of, you know, immoderately, you know, misguided, you know, like the Oliver Stone sort of goes and interviews politicians, completely fawns over them. You know, this is kind of clumsy, deeply clumsy.
Yeah.
You learn, you know, it's not that you learn nothing about Ukraine or about the conflict, but it's crammed in. I mean, it's one of the participants is Vice, and it's in that sort of zappy Vice style. I have to say, actually, there's a really good in-joke about Vice in one of the films, Disco Boy, where this completely clueless TV reporter turns up and says, "Hi, I'm from Vice US TV," and this African activist militia group just kind of take the piss out of her mercilessly.
Yeah, they kind of give her exactly what shoot guns in the air.
Yeah.
Well, I had to put it on record in case just so people know the nature of a superpower. And I mean, and his affect throughout the movie is also just like, "I'm going through a really hard time." It's like his problem, the Ukraine war.
Yeah. But his hair is extraordinary.
His hair is extraordinary.
I mean, what is he doing? You know, he's obviously, he's using the Boris Johnson technique of, you know, make sure it's really sort of ruffled before you take the lens cap off.
Yeah. It has its own climate system, basically. Well, we'll end with that, as always, with Champagne's hair, and bring this episode to a close. But
it's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure.
And see you in Cannes, I guess.
Yes, see you in Cannes. You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music. Thank you for listening.